actions give rise to suffering, and it denotes the implications of all this for our conduct. In other words, the Dharma is at once the truth about the way things are and the truth about how it makes sense to behave in light of the way things are. It is both description and prescription. It is the truth and the way. And because the Buddha's prescription is a prescription not just for liberation from suffering, but for right conduct, the word Dharma's denotations include a specifically moral one. Indeed, Dharma can be thought of as natural law, both in the sense of the law that the physical universe complies with and the moral law that we strive to comply with. The use of a single word to signify all this is itself testament to the order that, according to Buddhism, is normally hidden, but can become more evident as we diligently, as James might say, try to adjust ourselves to it. In case all this sounds too abstractly philosophical, let me try to put it in more practical form, as the answer to this oft-asked question. Will meditation make me happier? And if so, how much happier? Well, in my case, and as you will recall, I'm a particularly hard case, the answer is yes, it's made me a little happier. That's good, because I'm in favor of happiness, especially my own. At the same time, the argument I'd make to people about why they should meditate is less about the quantity of happiness than about the quality of the happiness. The happiness I now have involves, on balance, a truer view of the world than the happiness I had before. And a boost in happiness that rests on truth, I would argue, is better than a boost in happiness that doesn't. Not just because things that rest on truth have a more secure footing than things that don't, but because, as it happens, acting in accordance with this truth means behaving better toward your fellow beings. So that's why I'd say that any increments of happiness that insight meditation may add to your life are especially worth working for, because these are increments of valid happiness. This is a happiness that is based on a multifaceted clarity, on a truer view of the world, a truer view of other people, a truer view of yourself, and, I believe, a closer approximation to moral truth. It is this fortunate convergence of happiness, truth, and goodness that is embedded in the word Dharma, and that, I think, makes even a naturalistic Buddhism comply with William James's conception of religion. And if it turns out that the convergence has one more element, if widespread attention to the Dharma could save the planet, well, that's a nice bonus. Truth and Beauty. Late one day in mid-December 2012, I was at a meditation retreat and was outside doing some walking meditation. At some point, I looked up at the horizon and saw that the sun had set. All that was left was its pink and purple residue, framed austerely by barren winter trees. I was already in a mildly morose state, having been mulling some personal issue or other, and now I felt a distinct wave of melancholy, as I sometimes do upon seeing a winter twilight. Then, this being a retreat and me having spent much of each day observing my feelings, I immediately, almost reflexively, examined the melancholy. And right away, the feeling was drained of force. It didn't immediately disappear, but it now seemed like nothing more than physical waves, neither good nor bad, moving slowly through my body. With the melancholy neutralized, the horizon took on a different aspect. It was stunningly beautiful. It had gone from being a reflection of sadness to being a source of delight, even awe. This beauty, and all the other beauty I've appreciated more deeply as a result of meditative practice, is something I don't really understand. I mean, if meditation can give you a kind of distance from your feelings and lessen their hold on you, shouldn't it, in principle, do that equally for good and bad feelings? Shouldn't you wind up feeling more or less neutral, which is to say, feeling more or less nothing? Yet the way it seems to work is that some feelings actually get accentuated. first and foremost, the sensation of beauty. I sometimes think this heightened sense of beauty is what can give emptiness an ironic, moral power. Once you see less in the way of essence in people, once your perception of them is less imbued with judgments about their badness or goodness, there is, you might think, a greatly lessened reason to feel anything at all about them, including compassion. But if we're naturally inclined to think that things, including people, are beautiful, that inclination could translate into concern for their well-being. At least that's one theory as to why meditation can make people more compassionate. In any event, I remain flummoxed by what seems to be a natural tendency of contemplative practice to strengthen the sense of beauty. I guess one explanation is that, without really thinking about it, you're using mindfulness to filter your feelings, working harder to get critical distance from the unpleasant feelings than from the pleasant feelings, such as aesthetic delight. But for what it's worth, it doesn't feel like that. The sense of beauty feels more like something the mind just naturally relaxes into when the preoccupation with self subsides. I'm tempted to invoke John Keats's famous verse, "Beauty is truth, truth, beauty." But when you see the world more clearly, more truthfully, you enjoy not only a measure of liberation, but also a more direct and continuous perception of the world's actual beauty. On the other hand, the idea of the world having actual beauty, inherent beauty, seems at odds with the Buddhist emphasis on our tendency to impose meaning on the world. It's certainly at odds with the view from evolutionary psychology, which holds that our assignment of feelings to perceptions is indeed that, an assignment made by brains designed to feel certain ways about certain kinds of things based only on the relationship of those things to the organism's Darwinian interests. Another possibility is that a certain affinity for the universe is a kind of default state of consciousness, a state to which it returns when it's not caught up in the inherently distorting enterprise of operating a self. But here we're venturing beyond psychology into the philosophical question of what consciousness is, and my general view on that question is, beats me. There's a lot to dislike about the world we're born into. It's a world in which, as the Buddha noted, our natural way of seeing and of being leads us to suffer and to inflict suffering on others. And it's a world that, as we now know, was bound to be that way, given that life on this planet was created by natural selection. Still, it may also be a world in which metaphysical truth, moral truth, and happiness can align. And a world that, as you start to realize that alignment, appears more and more beautiful. If so, this hidden order, an order that seems to lie at a level deeper than natural selection itself, is something to marvel at. And it's something I'm increasingly thankful for. Appendix: A List of Buddhist Truths. While I was writing this book, I didn't have in mind the title, Why Buddhism is True. But after I finished writing it, I realized that the book did amount to an argument for the validity of what I consider the core ideas of Buddhism, or at least the core ideas of the naturalistic side of Buddhism, the side that Western Buddhism is mainly concerned with. So I went with the title, though, for reasons I assume are obvious, not without some trepidation. In the course of reassuring myself that the title was indeed warranted, I started listing particular Buddhist ideas that the book defends, and I decided that maybe such a list would be useful to readers or listeners. So I offer the list following, a kind of skeletal summary of the argument made in the course of the book, along with pointers to relevant chapters. Not all of the truths I list are Buddhist doctrines. Some are more like takeaways, clear implications of Buddhist thought. But all of them, I'm arguing, draw substantial corroboration from modern science, including modern neuroscience and psychology, with special emphasis on evolutionary psychology, that is, with special emphasis on the study of how natural selection shaped the human mind. And speaking of substantial corroboration from modern science, it's important to understand that, strictly speaking, that's all science ever offers. There is no such thing as a scientific theory that has been proven to be true, in the sense that mathematical theorems are proven true. To be sure, some theories now merit so much confidence that, for practical purposes, we can think of them as if they've been proven true. For example, I think the chances of the theory of natural selection being true are significantly greater than 99.99%, which is good enough for me. But some theories that merit much less confidence than that are nonetheless the leading theories in their field. The point is just that when we speak casually of a scientific theory being true, what we mean, strictly speaking, is that it has substantial corroborating evidence in its favor and has not yet encountered firm evidence that is incompatible with it. That's what the title of this book means in referring to core Buddhist ideas as true. These ideas draw corroboration, in some cases overwhelming corroboration, in some cases substantial but less than overwhelming corroboration, from the available evidence. I've tried in this book to signal roughly how much confidence I think different Buddhist ideas warrant. But I certainly think the core of Buddhism's assessment of the human condition, its basic view of why people suffer and why they make other people suffer, and more broadly, its conception of certain basic aspects of how the mind works and how we can change how our minds work, warrants enough confidence to get the label that the title of this book gives it. Okay, without further ado, here are some Buddhist truths. 1. Human beings often fail to see the world clearly, and this can lead them to suffer and to make others suffer. This costly misapprehension of the world can assume various forms, described in various ways in different Buddhist texts. For example, 2. Humans tend to anticipate more in the way of enduring satisfaction from the attainment of goals than will in fact transpire. This illusion and the resulting mindset of perpetual aspiration makes sense as a product of natural selection. See Chapter 1. But it's not exactly a recipe for lifelong happiness. 3. Dukkha is a relentlessly recurring part of life, as life is ordinarily lived. This fact is less evident if you translate dukkha as it's conventionally translated, as suffering, pure and simple, than if you translate it as involving a big component of unsatisfactoriness. Organisms, including humans, are designed by natural selection to react to their environments in ways that will make things better, in natural selection's sense of the term. This means they are almost always, at some level, scanning the horizon for things to be unhappy about, uncomfortable with, unsatisfied with. And since being unsatisfied, by definition, involves at least a little suffering, thinking of dukkha as entailing unsatisfactoriness winds up lending credence to the idea that dukkha in the sense of suffering is a pervasive part of life. See chapters 1 and 3. 4. The source of dukkha identified in the Four Noble Truths, tanha, translated as thirst or craving or desire, makes sense against the backdrop of evolution. Tanha, you might say, is what natural selection instilled in animals so they wouldn't be satisfied with anything for long. See Chapter 1. Seeing tanha as the source of suffering makes even more sense when it is construed broadly, as not only the desire to obtain and cling to pleasant things, but also the desire to escape from unpleasant things. See Chapter 13. Clearly, if you took the suffering associated with feelings of aversion out of the picture, that would take a lot of suffering out of the picture. 5. The two basic feelings that sponsor dukkha, the two sides of tanha, a clinging attraction to things and an aversion to things, needn't enslave us as they tend to. meditative disciplines such as mindfulness meditation can weaken the grip they exert. People disagree on whether complete and lasting liberation, nirvana in the classic sense of the term, is attainable, but there is no doubt that lives have been transformed by meditative practice. It's important to emphasize that becoming less enslaved by craving and aversion doesn't mean becoming numb to feelings. It can mean developing a different relationship to them and becoming more selective about which feelings to most fully engage with. Indeed, this revised relationship can include the accentuation of certain feelings, including wonder, compassion, and the sense of beauty. See chapters 2, 5, 8, 10, 13, and 16. 6. Our intuitive conception of the self is misleading at best. We tend to uncritically embrace all kinds of thoughts and feelings as ours, as part of us, when in fact that identification is optional. Recognizing that the identification is optional and learning, through meditation, how to make the identification less reflexive can reduce suffering. An understanding of why natural selection engineered various feelings into the human mind, see Chapter 3, can help validate the idea that we shouldn't uncritically accept the guidance of our feelings, and can help us choose which feelings to accept guidance from. To exercise this kind of discretion is to follow a strictly pragmatic rendering of Buddhism's famous not-self idea, a rendering that is a plausible interpretation of the foundational text on not-self, the second discourse the Buddha delivered after his enlightenment. See Chapter 5. 7. The more expansive and more common interpretation of the Buddha's second discourse, as saying that the self simply doesn't exist, is rendered in various ways in various Buddhist texts. A common rendering, that there is no CEO self, no self that is the doer of deeds, the thinker of thoughts, is substantially corroborated by modern psychology, which has shown the conscious self to be much less in charge of our behavior than it seems to be. A number of psychologists, including in particular evolutionary psychologists, subscribe to a modular model of the mind that is quite consistent with this view that there is no CEO self. This model can help explain a common apprehension of advanced meditators that thoughts think themselves. All told, what I call the interior version of the not-self experience, an experience that calls into question your ownership of your thoughts and feelings and calls into question the existence of the chief executive, you, that you normally think of as owning these things, draws validation both from experimental psychology and from prevailing ideas about how natural selection shaped the mind. See chapters 6, 7, and 8. 8. What I call the exterior version of the not-self experience, a sense that the bounds surrounding the self have dissolved and were in some sense illusory to begin with, is not empirically and theoretically corroborated in the same sense that, I argue, the interior version of the not-self experience is corroborated. Indeed, I'd say the exterior version is not in principle amenable to corroboration, in the same sense that the interior version can be corroborated, because it amounts to a claim that is less about psychology than about metaphysics, in the sense of the term metaphysics used in mainstream philosophy, not in any more exotic sense. At the same time, considerations from evolutionary biology suggest a distinct sense in which the bounds of the self can be thought of as arbitrary, which in turn suggests that sensing a kind of dissolution of the bounds of the self can be thought of as no less accurate an apprehension than our ordinary sense of the bounds of the self. See chapters 13 and 15. 9. Leaving aside the metaphysical validity of our ordinary sense of self and of alternatives to that ordinary sense of self, there is the question of moral validity. In particular, when a sense of the dissolution of the bounds of self, perhaps paired with the interior version of the not-self experience in the form of reduced identification with selfish impulses, leads to a less pronounced prioritization of my interests over the interests of others, does that move a person closer to moral truth? I argue that considerations from evolutionary biology support an affirmative answer to that question. See Chapter 15. 10. The intuition that objects and beings we perceive have essences is, as the Buddhist doctrine of emptiness holds, an illusion. Specifically, it is an illusion engineered by natural selection to identify the significance of things with respect to the Darwinian interests of the organisms doing the perceiving. See chapters 10 and 11. The Darwinian defense of the idea of emptiness is quite different from traditional Buddhist defenses of the idea, but it's compatible with them. Seeing essences in things doesn't always lead us to suffer or to inflict suffering on others, but it can. In particular, an essentialist view of other people and groups of people can lead us to countenance or intentionally cause their suffering. See Chapter 12. So awareness that essence is a perceptual construct, not a reality, can be valuable, especially if paired with meditative practice that dampens the sense of essence or permits selective engagement with it. Advanced meditators who report having lost a sense of essence fairly broadly, that is, who report apprehending emptiness or formlessness in a fairly thoroughgoing way, seem to be very happy and, in my limited experience, benevolent people. See Chapter 13. 11. The preceding point about essence and essentialism is one illustration of the broader proposition that not seeing the world clearly can lead not just to our own suffering, but to bad conduct in the sense of making others suffer needlessly. Or to put a more positive spin on it, seeing the world more clearly can make you not just happier, but more moral. This isn't a guaranteed outcome. There have been very good meditators who were, apparently, very happy and, manifestly, very bad people. Still, there is a close enough association between the psychological dynamics that make us suffer and the psychological dynamics that make us behave badly toward people that the Buddhist prescription for lessening or ending suffering will tend to make us not just happier, but better people. That this moral progress isn't guaranteed is one reason meditative instruction has typically been paired with a sort of ethical instruction that is so prominent in Buddhism. See Chapter 16. 12. Many Buddhist teachings, including several of those listed here, could be lumped under the rubric of awareness of conditioning, where conditioning means, roughly speaking, causes. Mindfulness meditation involves increased attentiveness to the things that cause our behavior, attentiveness to how perceptions influence our internal states, and how certain internal states lead to other internal states and to behaviors. This attentiveness includes an awareness of the critical role feelings seem to play in these chains of influence, a role shaped by natural selection, which seems to have calibrated feelings as part of its programming of our brains. Importantly, the meditative practices that bring awareness of these chains of influence also empower us to intervene and change the patterns of influence. To a large extent, that's what Buddhist liberation is. A fairly literal escape from chains of influence that had previously bound us and often to which we had previously been blind. See Chapter 14. So these are some of the main considerations that I hope justify the title, Why Buddhism is True. But if you want the shortest version of my answer to the question of why Buddhism is true, it's this. Because we are animals created by natural selection. Natural selection built into our brains the tendencies that early Buddhist thinkers did a pretty amazing job of sizing up, given the meager scientific resources at their disposal. Now, in light of the modern understanding of natural selection and the modern understanding of the human brain that natural selection produced, we can provide a new kind of defense of this sizing up. A note on terminology. Writing a book on Buddhism confronts you with a number of choices about terminology. For starters, there is the Sanskrit versus Pali question. In Western writing, Buddhist terms are usually rendered in one of these two ancient languages, though there are also ancient Buddhist texts in other Asian languages. Some authors of books about Buddhism pick one language or the other and stick with it. That's not the path I chose, and I thought I'd explain why. The first big Buddhist concept this book engages with at length, not self, is emphasized more in Theravada Buddhism than in the other main branch, Mahayana Buddhism. The Theravada canon is in Pali, so it felt natural to render not-self as anatta, as opposed to the Sanskrit anatman. But the second big Buddhist concept the book tackles, emptiness, gets more emphasis in the Mahayana tradition, and for that reason, the term is usually rendered in Sanskrit, sunyata. And a few key terms that are prominent in both traditions have, as it happens, become well known in the West in their Sanskrit forms, in particular, nirvana and dharma, as opposed to the Pali, nibbana and dhamma. So here I went with Sanskrit. Having made the decision to use both Sanskrit and Pali, I then had to face borderline cases, where there wasn't a particularly strong argument for either. I won't bore you with my reasons for making every choice I made. In some cases, I more or less flipped a coin. On the sutra, Sanskrit versus sutta, Pali issue, I've played it both ways, depending mainly on whether the text in question is more closely associated with the Mahayana or Theravada tradition. But this issue comes into play more in the notes and bibliography than in the text of the book itself, because in the text, I've tended to use the word discourse in preference to sutra or sutta. One reason is that I think in some circles the word sutra has come to connote something more like a poem or a reflection than an argument. And by and large, the Buddhist texts I'm focusing on make arguments. They may not make arguments in the modern sense of the word, all terms defined, each step in the argument clearly delineated, but they are advancing propositions about psychology or philosophy and giving reasons for them. And these propositions are at the heart of this book. Finally, I use the word enlightenment a lot in the book, and actually, awakening would be a more literally accurate translation of the ancient term that is commonly rendered as enlightenment. This is the term that is the basis both for the Buddha, awakened one, and for the name of the tree, the Bodhi tree, under which the Buddha is said to have had his great awakening. Awakening certainly has its appeal as a translation, given the Buddhist idea that we ordinarily live in such delusion as to be in a kind of dream world, and given that I begin the book by embracing that idea. At the same time, notwithstanding this metaphorical aptness, Buddhist awakening involves more than just waking up. There has to be actual enlightenment in the sense of apprehending, often arduously, some elusive truths about the world. As it happens, the term enlightenment has another relevant dimension. It signifies the era when the West made a decisive turn toward rational analysis. This struck me as apt, given this book's argument that the Buddhist worldview, or at least the naturalistic part of it, makes great sense by the lights of the philosophy and science that emanated from that era. Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment was written by Robert Wright and read by Fred Sanders. Editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Why Buddhism is True: The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.